Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. Free Fruit for Young Widows by Nathan Englander. When the Egyptian president Gamal Abdel Nasser took control of the Suez Canal, threatening Western access to that vital route, an agitated France shifted allegiances, joining forces with Britain and Israel against Egypt. This is a fact neither here nor there, except that during the 1956 Sinai campaign, there were soldiers in the Israeli army and soldiers in the Egyptian army who ended up wearing identical French-supplied uniforms to battle. Not long into the fighting, an Israeli platoon came to rest at a captured Egyptian camp to the east of Bir Gafa in the Sinai Desert. There, Private Shimi Gitzer, formerly Shimon Biberblatt of Warsaw, Poland, sat down to eat at a makeshift outdoor mess. Four armed commandos sat down with him. He grunted. They grunted. Shimi dug into his lunch. A squad mate of Shimi's came over to join them. Professor Tendler, who was then only Private Tendler, not yet a professor, and not yet even in possession of a high school degree, placed the tin cup that he was carrying on the edge of the table, taking care not to spill his tea. Then he took up his gun and shot each of the commandos in the head. They fell quite neatly. The first two, who had been facing Professor Tendler, tipped back off the bench into the sand. The second pair, who had their backs to the professor and were still staring open-mouthed at their dead friends, fell face down, the sound of their skulls hitting the table somehow more violent than the report of the gun. Shocked by the murder of four fellow soldiers, Shimi Gitzer tackled his friend. To Professor Tendler, who was much bigger than Shimi, the attack was more startling than threatening. Tendler grabbed hold of Shimi's hands while screaming, "Egyptians! Egyptians!" in Hebrew. He was using the same word about the same people in the same desert that had been used thousands of years before. The main difference, if the old stories are to be believed, was that God no longer raised his own fist in the fight. Professor Tendler quickly managed to contain Shimi in a bear hug. "Egyptian commandos, confused," Tendler said, switching to Yiddish. The enemy joined you for lunch." Shimi listened. Shimi calmed down. Professor Tendler, thinking the matter was settled, let Shimi go. As soon as he did, Shimi swung wildly. He continued attacking, because who cared who these four men were? They were people. They were human beings who had sat down at the wrong table for lunch. They were dead people who had not had to die. "You could have taken them prisoner," Shimi yelled. "Halt," he screamed in German. "That's all, halt." Then, with tears streaming and fists flying, Shimi said, "You didn't have to shoot." By then, Professor Tendler had had enough. He proceeded to beat Shimi Gitzer. He didn't just defend himself. He didn't subdue his friend. He flipped Shimi over, straddled his body, and pounded it down until it was level with the sand. He beat his friend until his friend couldn't take any more beating, and then he beat him some more. Finally, he climbed off his friend, looked up into the hot sun, and pushed through the crowd of soldiers who had assembled in the minutes since the Egyptians sat down to their fate. Tendler went off to have a smoke. For those who had come running at the sound of gunfire to find five bodies in the sand, it was a consensus that a pummeled Shimi Gitzer looked to be in the worst condition of the bunch. At the fruit and vegetable stand that Shimi Gitzer eventually opened in Jerusalem's Mahani Yehuda market, his son, little Etgar, asked about the story of Professor Tendler again and again. From the time he was six, Etgar had worked at the Dukhan at his father's side whenever he wasn't in school. At that age, knowing only a child's version of the story, that Tendler had done something in one of the wars that upset Edgar's father, and Edgar's father had jumped on the man, and the man had, his father never hesitated to admit, beat him up very badly, Edgar couldn't understand why his father was so nice to the professor now. Reared as he was on the laws of the small family business, Edgar couldn't grasp why he was forbidden to accept a single lira from Tendler. The professor got his vegetables free. After Edgar weighed the tomatoes and the cucumbers, his father would take up this bag, stick in a nice fat eggplant, unasked, and pass it over to Professor Tendler. "Catch," his father would say, "take it, and wish your wife well." As Edgar turned 9 and 10 and 11, the story began to fill out. He was told about the commandos in the uniforms, about shipping routes in the Suez, and the Americans and the British and the French. He learned about the shots to the head. He learned about all the wars his father had fought in, 73, 67, 56, 48, though Shimigetzer still stopped short of the one he'd first been swept up in, the war that ran from 1939 to 1945. Edgar's father explained the hazy morality of combat, the split-second decisions, the assessment of threat and response, the nature of percentages and absolutes. Shimmy did his best to make clear to his son that Israelis, in their nation of unfinished borders and unwritten constitution, were trapped in a gray space that was called real life. In this gray space, he explained, even absolutes could maintain more than one position, reflect more than one truth. You too, he said to his son, may someday face a decision such as Professor Tendler's. May you never know from it. He pointed to the bloody stall across from theirs, pointed at a fish below the mallet flopping on the block. God forbid you should have to live with the consequences of decisions, permanent, eternal, that will chase you in your head, turning from this side to that, tossing between wrong and right. But Edgar still couldn't comprehend how his father saw the story to be that of a fish flip-flopping when it was, in his eyes, only ever about that mallet coming down. Edgar wasn't one for the gray. He was a tiny, thoughtful, buck-toothed boy of certainties, and every Friday when Tendler came by the stand, Edgar would pack up the man's produce and then run through the story again, searching for black and white. This man had saved his father's life, but maybe he hadn't. He'd done what was necessary, but maybe he could have done it another way. And even if the basic schoolyard rule applied in adult life, that a beating delivered earns a beating in return, did it ever justify one as fierce as the beating his father had described? A pummeling so severe that Shimmy, while telling the story, would run Edgar's fingers along his left cheek to show him where Professor Tendler had flattened the bone. Even if the violence had been justified, even if his father didn't always say, you must risk your friend's life, your family's, your own, you must be willing to die even to save the life of your enemy, if ever, of two deeds, the humane one may be done. It was not his father's act of forgiveness, but his kindness that baffled Edgar. Shimmy would send him running across Agrippa Street to bring back two cups of coffee or two glasses of tea to welcome Professor Tendler, telling Edgar to snatch a good-sized handful of pistachios from Eisenberg's cart along the way. This treatment his father reserved only for his oldest friends. And absolutely no one but the war widows got their produce free. Quietly and with dignity, so as to cause these women no shame, Edgar's father would send them off with fresh fruit and big bags of vegetables, sometimes for years after their losses. He always took care of the young widows. When they protested, he'd say, "You sacrifice, I sacrifice. All in all, what's a bag of apples?" "It's all for one country," he'd say. When it came to Professor Tendler, so clear an answer never came. When Edgar was 12, his father acknowledged the complexities of Tendler's tale. "Do you want to know why I care for a man who once beat me? Because to a story there is context. There's always context in life." "That's it?" Edgar asked. "That's it." At 13, he was told a different story, because at 13, Edgar was a man. "You know I was in the war," Shimmy said to his son. The way he said it, Edgar knew that he didn't mean 48 or 56, 67 or 73. He did not mean the Jewish wars, in all of which he had fought. He meant the big one, the war that no one in his family but Shimmy had survived, which was also the case for Edgar's mother. This was why they had taken a new name, Shimmy explained. In the whole world, the Getzers were three. "Yes," Edgar said, "I know." "Professor Tendler was also in that war," Shimmy said. "Yes," Edgar said. "It was hard on him," Shimmy said, "and that is why I am always nice." Edgar thought. Edgar spoke. "But you were there, too. You've had the same life as him, and you'd never have shot four men, even the enemy, if you could have taken them prisoner, if you could have spared a life. Even if you were in danger, you'd risk..." Edgar's father smiled and stopped him. "Hodem kol," he said. "A similar life is not a same life. There is a difference." Here Shimmy's face turned serious, the lightness gone. "In that first war, in that big war, I was the lucky one," he said. "In the Shoah, I survived." "But he's here," Edgar said. "He survived just the same as you." No, Edgar's father said. He made it through the camps. He walks, he breathes, and he was very close to making it out of Europe alive. But they killed him. After the war, we still lost people. They killed what was left of him in the end. For the first time, without Professor Tendler there, without one of Shimmy's friends from the ghetto who stopped by to talk in Yiddish, without one of the soldier buddies from his unit in the reserves, or one of the kibbutzniks from whom he bought his fruits and his vegetables, Edgar's father sent Edgar across Agrippa Street to get two glasses of tea, one for Edgar and one for him. "Hurry," Shimmy said, sending Edgar off with a slap on his behind. Before Edgar had taken a step, his father grabbed his collar and popped open the register, handing him a brand new 10-shekel bill. "And buy us a nice big bag of seeds from Eisenberg. Tell him to keep the change. You and I, we're going to sit a while." Shimmy took out the second folding chair from behind the register. It would also be the first time that father and son had ever sat down in the store together. Another rule of good business: a customer should always find you standing. Always there's something you can be doing. Sweeping, stacking, polishing apples. The customers will come to a place where there is pride. This is why Professor Tendler got his tomatoes free, why the sight of the man who beat Shimmy made his gaze go soft with kindness in the way that it did when one of the Miskinot came by, why it took on what Edgar called his father's free fruit for young widow's eyes. This is the story that Shimmy told Edgar when he felt that his boy was a man. The first thing Professor Tendler saw when his death camp was liberated was two big, tough American soldiers fainting dead away. The pair, presumably war-hardened, stood before the immense, heretofore unimaginable brutality of modern extermination, frozen, slack-jawed, before a mountain of putrid, naked corpses, a hill of men. And from this pile of broken bodies that had been, prior to the American invasion, set to be burned, a rickety skeletal Tendler stared back. Professor Tendler stared and studied, and when he was sure that these soldiers were not Nazi soldiers, he crawled out from his hiding place among the corpses, pushing and shoving those balsa wood arms and legs aside. It was this hill of bodies that protected Tendler day after day. The poor Sonderkommandos who dumped the bodies, as well as those who came to cart them to the ovens, knew that the boy was inside. They brought him the crumbs of their crumbs to keep him going, and though it was certain death for these prisoners to protect him, it allowed them a sliver of humanity in their inhuman jobs. This was what Shimmy was trying to explain to his son, that these palest shadows of kindness were enough to keep a dead man alive. When Tendler finally got to his feet, straightening his body out, when the corpse that was Professor Tendler at age 13, your age, came crawling from that nightmare, he looked at the two Yankee soldiers who looked at him and then hit the ground with a thud. Professor Tendler had already seen so much in life that this was not worth even a pause, and so he walked on. He walked on naked through the gates of the camp, walked on until he got some food and some clothes, walked on until he had shoes and then a coat. He walked on until he had a little bread and a potato in his pocket, a surplus. Soon there was also in that pocket a cigarette, and then a second, a coin, and then a second. Surviving in this way, Tendler walked across borders until he was able to stand straight and tall, until he showed up in his childhood town in a matching suit of clothes, with a few bills in his pocket and in his waistband a six-shooter with five bullets, chambered, in order to protect himself during the nights that he slept by the side of the road. Professor Tendler was expecting no surprises, no reunions. He'd seen his mother killed in front of him, his father, his three sisters, his grandparents, and after some months in the camp, the two boys that he knew from back home. But home, that was the thing he held on to. Maybe his house was still there, and his bed. Maybe the cow was still giving milk, and the goat still chewing garbage, and his dog still barking at the chickens as before. And maybe his other family, the nurse at whose breast he had become strong, before weakened, her husband who had farmed his father's field, and their son, his age, and another, 2 years younger, boys with whom he had played like a brother. Maybe this family was still there waiting for him to come home. Tendler could make a new family in that house. He could call every child he might one day have by his dead loved ones' names. The town looked as it had when he'd left. The streets were his streets, the linden trees in the square taller but laid out as before. And when Tendler turned down the dirt road that led to his gate, He fought to keep himself from running, and he fought to keep himself from crying, because after what he had seen, he knew that to survive in this world he must always act like a man. So Tendler buttoned his coat and walked quietly toward the fence, wishing that he had a hat to take off as he passed through the gate, just the way the man of the house would when coming home to what was his. But when he saw her in the yard, when he saw Fanushka, his nurse, their maid, the tears came anyway. Tendler popped a precious button from his coat as he ran to her and threw himself into her arms, and he cried for the first time since the trains. With her husband at her side, Fanushka said to him, "Welcome home, son," and "Welcome home, child," and "We prayed, we lit candles, we dreamed of your return." When they asked, "Are your parents also coming? Are your sisters and your grandparents far behind?" When they asked after all the old neighbors, house by house, Tendler answered, not by metaphor and not by insinuation. When he knew the fate, he stated it as it was. Beaten or starved, shot, cut in half, the front of the head caved in. All this he related without feeling, matters, each a fact. All this he shared before venturing a step through his front door. Looking through that open door, Tendler decided that he would live with these people as family until he had a family of his own. He would grow old in this house. Free to be free, he would gate himself up again. But it would be his gate, his lock, his world. A hand on his hand pulled him from his reverie. It was Fanushka talking, a sad smile on her face. "Time to fatten you up," she said, "a feast for first dinner." And she grabbed the chicken at her feet and twisted its neck right there in the yard. "Come in," she said, while the animal twitched. "The master of the house has returned." "Just as you left it," she said. "Only a few of our things." Tendler stepped inside. It was exactly as he remembered it, the table, the chairs, except that all that was personal was gone. Fanushka's two sons came in, and Tendler understood what time had done. These boys, fed and housed, warmed and loved, were fully twice his size. He felt then something he had never known in the camps. A civilized emotion that would have served no use. Tendler felt ashamed. He turned red, clenched his jaw tight, and felt his gums bleeding into his mouth. "You have to understand," Edgar's father said to his son. These boys, his brothers, they were now twice his size and strangers to him. The boys, prodded, shook hands with Tendler. They did not know him any more. "Still, it's a nice story," Edgar said. "Sad, but also happy. He makes it home to a home. It's what you always say, survival, that's what matters, surviving to start again." Edgar's father held up a sunflower seed, thinking about this. He cracked it between his front teeth. "So they're all making a dinner for Professor Tendler," he said, "and he's sitting on the kitchen floor, legs crossed, as he did when he was a boy, and he is watching happily, drinking a glass of goat's milk, still warm. And then the father goes out to slaughter that goat. A feast for dinner," he says. "A chicken's not enough." Professor Tendler, who has not had meat in years, looks at him, and the father, running a nail along his knife, says, "I remember the kosher way." Tendler was so happy that he could not bear it, so happy and so sad. And with the cup of warm milk and the warm feeling, Tendler had to pee. But he didn't want to move now that he was there with his other mother and resting on her shoulder, a baby sister, a year and a half old and one curl on her head. A little girl, fat and happy, fat in the ankle, fat in the wrist. Professor Tendler rushed out at the last second, out of the warm kitchen, out from under his roof. Professor Tendler, a man whom other men had tried to turn into an animal, did not race to the outhouse. It didn't cross his mind. He stood right under the kitchen window to smell the kitchen smells, to stay close. And he took a piss. Over the sound of the stream, he heard his nurse lamenting. He knew what she must be lamenting. The Tendler family destroyed. He listened to what she was saying, and he heard. "He will take everything," is what she said. "He will take it all from us, our house, our field. He will snatch away all we've built and protected, everything that has been, for so long, ours." There outside the window, pissing and listening, and also disassociating, as Professor Tendler would call it, though he did not then have the word, he knew only that he was watching himself from above, that he could see himself feeling all the disappointment as he felt it, until he was keenly and wildly aware that he had felt nothing all those years, felt nothing when his father and his mother were shot, felt nothing while in the camps, Nothing, in fact, from the moment he was driven from his home to the moment he returned. In that instant, Tendler's guilt was sharper than any sensation he had ever known. And here, in response to his precocious son, Shimmy said, "Yes, yes, of course it was about survival. Tendler's way of coping, of course he'd been feeling all along." But Tendler, a boy who had stepped over his mother's body and kept walking, had, for those peasants, opened up. It was right then, Professor Tendler later told Shimmy, that he became a philosopher. "He will steal it all away," Fanushka said. "Everything. He has come for our lives." And her son, whom Tendler had considered a brother, said, "No." And Tendler's other, almost brother, said, "No." "We will eat," Fanushka said. "We will celebrate. And when he sleeps, we will kill him." To one of the sons, she said, "Go, tell your father to keep that knife sharp." To the other, she said, "You get to sleep early, and you get up early, and before you grab the first hit on that cow, I want his throat slit. Ours, ours, not to be taken away." Tendler ran, not toward the street, but back toward the outhouse, in time to turn around as the kitchen door flew open, in time to smile at the younger brother on his way to find his father, in time for Tendler to be heading back the right way. "Do you want to hear what was shared at such a dinner?" Shimmy asked his son. The memories roused and oaths sworn. "There was wine, I know." "Drink, drink," the mother said. "There was a chicken and a pot of goat stew, and in a time of great deprivation there was also sugar for the tea." At this, Shimmy pointed at the bounty of their stand. And as if nothing, next to the baby's basket on the kitchen floor sat a basket of apples. Tendler hadn't had an apple in who knows how long. Tendler brought the basket to the table. The family laughed as he peeled the apples with a knife, first eating the peels, then the flesh, and savoring even the seeds and the cores. It was a celebration, a joyous night, so much so that Professor Tendler could not, by its end, belly distended, eyes crossed with drink, believe what he knew to have been said. There were hugs and there were kisses, and Tendler, the master of the house, was given his parents' bedroom upstairs, the two boys across the hall. And below in the kitchen, it will be warmest, slept the mother and the father and the fat-ankled girl. "Sleep well," Fanushka said. "Welcome home, my son." And sweetly she kissed Tendler on both eyes. Tendler climbed the stairs. He took off his suit and went to bed. And that was where he was when Fanushka popped through the door and asked him if he was warm enough, if he needed a lamp by which to read. "No, thank you," he said. "So formal? No thanks necessary," Fanushka said. "Only yes, mother, or no, mother, my poor reclaimed orphan son." "No light, mother," Tendler said, and Fanushka closed the door. Tendler got out of bed. He put on his suit. Once again, without any shame to his actions, Tendler searched the room for anything of value, robbing his own home. Then he waited. He waited until the house had settled into itself, the last creak slipping from the floorboards as the walls pushed back against the wind. He waited until his mother, his Fanushka, must surely sleep, until a brother intent on staying up for the night, a brother who had never once fought for his life, convinced himself that it would be all right to close his eyes. Tendler waited until he, too, had to sleep, and that's when he tied the laces of his shoes together and hung them over his shoulder. That's when he took his pillow with one hand and with the other quietly cocked his gun. Then, with goose feathers flying, Tendler moved through the house, a bullet for each brother, one for the father and one for the mother. Tendler fired until he found himself standing in the warmth of the kitchen, one bullet left to protect him on the nights when he would sleep by the side of the road. That last bullet Tendler left in the fat baby girl because he did not know from mercy and did not need to leave another of that family to grow to kill him at some future time. "He murdered them," Edgar said, "a murderer." "No," his father told him, "there was no such notion at the time." "Even so, it's murder," Edgar said. "If it is, then it's only fair. They killed him first. It was his right." "But you always say, context." "But the baby, the girl." "The baby is hardest, I admit, but these are questions for the philosopher. These are the theoretical instances put into flesh and blood." "But it's not a question. These people, they're not the ones who murdered his family. They were coming for him that night. He could have escaped. He could have run for the gate when he overheard. He didn't need to race back toward the outhouse, race to face the brother as he came the other way." "Maybe there was no more running in him. Anyway, do you understand an eye for an eye? Can you imagine a broader meaning of self-defense? You always forgive him, Edgar said. You suffered the same things, but you aren't that way. You would not have done what he did. It's hard to know what a person would and wouldn't do in any specific instance. And you, spoiled child, apply the rules of civilization to a boy who had seen only its opposite. Maybe the fault for those deaths lies in a system designed for the killing of tendlers that failed to do its job. An error, a slip that allowed a tendler, no longer fit, back loose in the world. Is that what you think? It's what I ask, and I ask you, my Edgar, what would you have done if you were Tendler that night? Not kill, then you die. Only the grown-ups. But it was a boy who was sent to cut Tendler's throat. How about killing only those who would do harm? Still, it's murder. Still, it's killing people who have yet to act, murdering them in their sleep. I guess, Edgar said, I can see how they deserved it, the four. How I might, if I were him, have killed them. Shimmy shook his head, looking sad. And whoever are we, my son, to decide who should die? It was on that day that Edgar Gezer became a philosopher himself, not in the manner of Professor Tendler, who taught theories up at the university on the mountain, but like his father, practical and concrete. Edgar would not finish high school or go to college, and except for his 3 years in the army, he would spend his life happily working the stand in the shuk. He'd stack the fruit into pyramids and contemplate weighty questions with the seriousness of thought. And when there were answers, Edgar would try employing them to make for himself and others, in whatever small way, a better life. It was on that day, too, that Edgar decided Professor Tendler was both a murderer and at the same time a miskin. He believed he understood how and why Professor Tendler had come to kill that peasant family, and how men sent to battle in uniform, even in the same uniform, would find no mercy at his hand. Edgar also came to see how Tendler's story could just as easily have ended for the professor that first night, back in his parents' room, in his parents' bed, a gun with four bullets held in a suicide's hand, how the first bullet Tendler ever fired might have been into his own head. Still, every Friday, Edgar packed up Tendler's fruit and vegetables, and in that bag Edgar would add, when he had them, a pineapple or a few fat mangoes dripping honey. Handing him to Tendler, Edgar would say, "Kutch, Professor, take it." This even after his father had died. And that story was Free Fruit for Young Widows by Nathan Englander from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. The Mummy's Foot by Théophile Gautier. I had entered in an idle mood the shop of one of those curiosity vendors who are called marchands de bric-a-brac in that Parisian argot which is so perfectly unintelligible elsewhere in France. You have doubtless glanced occasionally through the window of some of these shops, which have become so numerous now that it's fashionable to buy antiquated furniture, and that every petty stockbroker thinks he must have his chambre au moyen âge. There is one thing there which clings alike to the shop of the dealer in old iron, the ware-room of the tapestry maker, the laboratory of the chemist, and the studio of the painter. In all those gloomy dens where a furtive daylight filters in through the window shutters, the most manifestly ancient thing is dust. The cobwebs are more authentic than the gimp laces, and the old pear-tree furniture on exhibition is actually younger than the mahogany which arrived but yesterday from America. The warehouse of my bric-a-brac dealer was a veritable Capernaum. All ages and all nations seemed to have made their rendezvous there. An Etruscan lamp of red clay stood upon a boule cabinet, with ebony panels, brightly striped by lines of inlaid brass. A duchess of the court of Louis XV nonchalantly extended her fawn-like feet under a massive table of the time of Louis XIII, with heavy spiral supports of oak and carven designs of chimeras and foliage intermingled. Upon the denticulated shelves of several sideboards glittered immense Japanese dishes with red and blue designs relieved by gilded hatching, side by side with enameled works by Bernard Palissy, representing serpents, frogs, and lizards in relief. From disemboweled cabinets escaped cascades of silver lustrous Chinese silks and waves of tinsel, which an oblique sunbeam shot through with luminous beads, while portraits of every era, in frames more or less tarnished, smiled through their yellow varnish. The striped breastplate of a Damascene suit of Milanese armor glittered in one corner. Loves and nymphs of porcelain, Chinese grotesques, vases of celadon and crackleware, Saxon and old Sevres cups encumbered the shelves and nooks of the department. The dealer followed me closely through the tortuous way contrived between the piles of furniture, warding off with his hand the hazardous sweep of my coat skirts, watching my elbows with the uneasy attention of an antiquarian and an usurer. It was a singular face, that of the merchant, an immense skull, polished like a knee, and surrounded by a thin aureole of white hair, which brought out the clear salmon tint of his complexion all the more strikingly, lent him a false aspect of patriarchal bonhomie, counteracted, however, by the scintillation of two little yellow eyes which trembled in their orbits like two louis d'or upon quicksilver. The curve of his nose presented an aquiline silhouette which suggested the Oriental or Jewish type. His hands, thin, slender, full of nerves which projected like strings upon the fingerboard of a violin, and armed with claws like those on the terminations of bat's wings, shook with senile trembling. But those convulsively agitated hands became firmer than steel pincers or lobster's claws when they lifted any precious article. An onyx cup, a Venetian glass, or a dish of Bohemian crystal. This strange old man had an aspect so thoroughly rabbinical and cabalistic that he would have been burnt on the mere testimony of his face 3 centuries ago. "Will you not buy something from me today, sir? Here is a Malay crease with a blade undulating like flame. Look at those grooves contrived for the blood to run along, those teeth set backward so as to tear out the entrails in withdrawing the weapon. It is a fine character of ferocious arm and will look well in your collection. This two-handed sword is very beautiful. It is the work of Giuseppe de la Hera. And this colliche marred with its fenestrated guard, what a superb specimen of handicraft. No, I've quite enough weapons and instruments of carnage. I want a small figure, something which will suit me as a paperweight, for I cannot endure those trumpery bronzes which the stationers sell and which may be found on everybody's desk." The old gnome foraged among his ancient wares and finally arranged before me some antique bronzes, so called at least, fragments of malachite, little Hindu or Chinese idols, a kind of pusa toys in jade stone representing the incarnations of Brahma or Vishnu, and wonderfully appropriate to the very undivine office of holding papers and letters in place. I was hesitating between a porcelain dragon, all constellated with warts, its mouth formidable with bristling tusks and ranges of teeth, and an abominable little Mexican fetish representing the god Vitzilipuzli el Natural, when I caught sight of a charming foot, which I at first took for a fragment of some antique Venus. It had those beautiful ruddy and tawny tints that lend to Florentine bronze that warm living look so much preferable to the gray-green aspect of common bronzes, which might easily be mistaken for statues in a state of putrefaction. Satiny gleams played over its rounded forms, doubtless polished by the amorous kisses of 20 centuries, for it seemed a Corinthian bronze, a work of the best era of art, perhaps molded by Lipsius himself. "That foot will be my choice," I said to the merchant, who regarded me with an ironical and saturnine air, and held out the object desired that I might examine it more fully. I was surprised at its lightness. It was not a foot of metal, but in sooth a foot of flesh, an embalmed foot, a mummy's foot. On examining it still more closely, the very grain of the skin and the almost imperceptible lines impressed upon it by the texture of the bandages became perceptible. The toes were slender and delicate, and terminated by perfectly formed nails, pure and transparent as agates. The great toe, slightly separated from the rest, afforded a happy contrast, in the antique style, to the position of the other toes, and lent it an aerial lightness, the grace of a bird's foot. The sole, scarcely streaked by a few almost imperceptible cross lines, afforded evidence that it had never touched the bare ground, and had only come in contact with the finest matting of Nile rushes and the softest carpets of panther skin. "Aha, you want the foot of the Princess Hermonthis," exclaimed the merchant with a strange giggle, fixing his owlish eyes upon me. "Ha, ha, ha! For a paperweight! An original idea! Artistic idea! Old Pharaoh would certainly have been surprised had someone told him that the foot of his adored daughter would be used for a paperweight after he had had a mountain of granite hollowed out as a receptacle for the triple coffin, painted and gilded. covered with hieroglyphics and beautiful paintings of the judgment of souls, continued the queer little merchant, half audibly as though talking to himself. How much will you charge me for this mummy fragment? Ah, the highest price I can get, for it is a superb piece. If I had the match of it, you could not have it for less than 500 francs. The daughter of a pharaoh, nothing is more rare. Assuredly, that is not a common article, but still, how much do you want? In the first place, let me warn you that all my wealth consists of just 5 louis. I can buy anything that costs 5 louis, but nothing dearer. You might search my vest pockets and most secret drawers without even finding one poor little 5-franc piece more. 5 louis for the foot of the Princess Hermonthis, that is very little, very little indeed. 'Tis an authentic foot, muttered the merchant, shaking his head and imparting a peculiar rotary motion to his eyes. Well, take it, and I will give you the bandages into the bargain, he added, wrapping the foot in an ancient damask rag. Very fine, real damask, Indian damask, which has never been re-dyed. It is strong, and yet it is soft, he mumbled, stroking the frayed tissue with his fingers, through the trade-acquired habit which moved him to praise even an object of so little value that he himself deemed it only worth the giving away. He poured the gold coins into a sort of medieval alms purse hanging at his belt, repeating, "The foot of the Princess Hermonthis, to be used for a paperweight." Then turning his phosphorescent eyes upon me, he exclaimed in a voice strident as the crying of a cat which has swallowed a fishbone, "Old Pharaoh will not be well pleased. He loved his daughter, the dear man. You speak as if you were a contemporary of his. You are old enough, goodness knows. But you do not date back to the pyramids of Egypt," I answered, laughingly, from the threshold. I went home delighted with my acquisition. With the idea of putting it to profitable use as possible, I placed the foot of the divine Princess Hermonthis upon a heap of paper scribbled over with verses, in themselves an undecipherable mosaic work of erasures, articles freshly begun, letters forgotten and posted in the table drawer instead of the letterbox, an error to which absent-minded people are peculiarly liable. The effect was charming, bizarre, and romantic. Well satisfied with this embellishment, I went out with a gravity and pride, becoming one who feels that he has the ineffable advantage over all the passers-by whom he elbows, of possessing a piece of the Princess Hermonthis, daughter of Pharaoh. I looked upon all who did not possess, like myself, a paperweight so authentically Egyptian, as very ridiculous people, and it seemed to me that the proper occupation of every sensible man should consist in the mere fact of having a mummy's foot upon his desk. Happily I met some friends whose presence distracted me in my infatuation with this new acquisition. I went to dinner with them, for I could not very well have dined with myself. When I came back that evening, with my brain slightly confused by a few glasses of wine, a vague whiff of oriental perfume delicately titillated my olfactory nerves. The heat of the room had warmed the natron, bitumen, and myrrh in which the parakeets who cut open the bodies of the dead had bathed the corpse of the princess. It was a perfume at once sweet and penetrating, a perfume that 4,000 years had not been able to dissipate. The dream of Egypt was eternity. Her odors have the solidity of granite and endure as long. I soon drank deeply from the black cup of sleep. For a few hours all remained opaque to me. Oblivion and nothingness inundated me with their somber waves. Yet light gradually dawned upon the darkness of my mind. Dreams commenced to touch me softly in their silent flight. The eyes of my soul were opened, and I beheld my chamber as it actually was. I might have believed myself awake, but for a vague consciousness which assured me that I slept, and that something fantastic was about to take place. The odor of the myrrh had augmented in intensity, and I felt a slight headache, which I very naturally attributed to several glasses of champagne that we had drunk to the unknown gods and our future fortunes. I peered through my room with a feeling of expectation which I saw nothing to justify. Every article of furniture was in its proper place. The lamp, softly shaded by its globe of ground crystal, burned upon its bracket. The watercolor sketches shone under the bohemian glass. The curtains hung down languidly. Everything wore an aspect of tranquil slumber. After a few moments, however, all this calm interior appeared to become disturbed. The woodwork cracked stealthily, the ash-covered logs suddenly emitted a jet of blue flame, and the discs of the patera seemed like great metallic eyes, watching, like myself, for the things which were about to happen. My eyes accidentally fell upon the desk where I'd placed the foot of the Princess Hermonthis. Instead of remaining quiet, as behooved a foot which had been embalmed for 4,000 years, it commenced to act in a nervous manner, contracted itself, and leaped over the papers like a startled frog. One would have imagined that it had suddenly been brought into contact with a galvanic battery. I could distinctly hear the dry sound made by its little heel, hard as the hoof of a gazelle. I became rather discontented with my acquisition, inasmuch as I wished my paperweights to be of a sedentary disposition, and thought it very unnatural that feet should walk about without legs, and I commenced to experience a feeling closely akin to fear. Suddenly I saw the folds of my bed curtain stir and heard a bumping sound, like that caused by some person hopping on one foot across the floor. I must confess I became alternately hot and cold, that I felt a strange wind chill my back, and that my suddenly rising hair caused my nightcap to execute a leap of several yards. The bed curtain opened, and I beheld the strangest figure imaginable before me. It was a young girl of a very deep coffee-brown complexion, like the Bayadere Armani, and possessing the purest Egyptian type of perfect beauty. Her eyes were almond-shaped and oblique, with eyebrows so black that they seemed blue. Her nose was exquisitely chiseled, almost Greek in its delicacy of outline, and she might indeed have been taken for a Corinthian statue of bronze, but for the prominence of her cheekbones and the slightly African fullness of her lips, which compelled one to recognize her as belonging beyond all doubt to the hieroglyphic race which dwelt upon the banks of the Nile. Her arms, slender and spindle-shaped, like those of very young girls, were encircled by a peculiar kind of metal bands and bracelets of glass beads. Her hair was all twisted into little cords, and she wore upon her bosom a little idle figure of green paste, bearing a whip with 7 lashes, which proved it to be an image of Isis. Her brow was adorned with a shining plate of gold, and a few traces of paint relieved the coppery tint of her cheeks. As for her costume, it was very odd indeed. Fancy a panya, or skirt, all formed of little strips of material bedizened with red and black hieroglyphics, stiffened with bitumen, and apparently belonging to freshly unbandaged mummy. In one of those sudden flights of thought so common in dreams, I heard the hoarse falsetto of the bric-a-brac dealer repeating like a monotonous refrain the phrase he had uttered in his shop with so enigmatical an intonation. Old Pharaoh will not be well pleased. He loved his daughter, the dear man. One strange circumstance, which was not at all calculated to restore my equanimity, was that the apparition had but one foot. The other was broken off at the ankle. She approached the table where the foot was starting and fidgeting about more than ever, and there supported herself upon the edge of the desk. I saw her eyes fill with pearly gleaming tears. Although she had not as yet spoken, I fully comprehended the thoughts which agitated her. She looked at her foot, for it was indeed her own, with an exquisitely graceful expression of coquettish sadness, but the foot leaped and ran hither and thither as though impelled on steel springs. Twice or thrice she extended her hand to seize it, but could not succeed. Then commenced between the Princess Hermonthis and her foot, which appeared to be endowed with a special life of its own, a very fantastic dialogue in a most ancient Coptic tongue, such as might have been spoken 30 centuries ago in the syrinxes of the land of Sur. Luckily, I understood Coptic perfectly well that night. The Princess Hermonthis cried in a voice sweet and vibrant as the tones of a crystal bell. "Well, my dear little foot, you will always flee from me, yet I always took good care of you. I bathed you with perfumed water in a bowl of alabaster. I smoothed your heel with pumice stone mixed with palm oil. Your nails were cut with golden scissors and polished with a hippopotamus tooth. I was careful to select totbebs for you, painted, embroidered, and turned up at the toes, which were the envy of all the young girls in Egypt. You wore on your great toe rings bearing the device of the sacred scarabaeus, and you supported one of the lightest bodies that a lazy foot could sustain." The foot replied in a pouting and chagrined tone. "You know well that I do not belong to myself any longer. I have been bought and paid for. The old merchant knew what he was about. He bore you a grudge for having refused to espouse him. This is an ill turn which he has done you. The Arab who violated your royal coffin in the subterranean pits of the necropolis of Thebes was sent hither by him. He desired to prevent you from being present at the reunion of the shadowy nations in the cities below. Have you 5 pieces of gold for my ransom? Alas, no. My jewels, my rings, my purses of gold and silver were all stolen from me, answered the Princess Hermonthis with a sob. Princess, I then exclaimed, I never retained anybody's foot unjustly, even though you have not got the 5 louis which it cost me. I present it to you gladly. I should feel unutterably wretched to think that I were the cause of so amiable a person as the Princess Hermonthis being lame. I delivered this discourse in a royally gallant troubadour tone, which must have astonished the beautiful Egyptian girl. She turned a look of deepest gratitude upon me, and her eyes shone with bluish gleams of light. She took her foot, which surrendered itself willingly this time, like a woman about to put on her little shoe, and adjusted it to her leg with much skill. This operation over, she took a few steps about the room, as though to assure herself that she was really no longer lame. Ah, how pleased my father will be, he who was so unhappy because of my mutilation, and who from the moment of my birth set a whole nation at work to hollow me out a tomb so deep that he might preserve me intact until that last day, when souls must be weighed in the balance of Amenthe. Come with me to my father. He will receive you kindly, for you have given me back my foot. I thought this proposition natural enough. I arrayed myself in a dressing gown of large flowered pattern, which lent me a very pharaonic aspect, hurriedly put on a pair of Turkish slippers, and informed the Princess Hermonthis that I was ready to follow her. Before starting, Hermonthis took from her neck the little idol of green paste and laid it on the scattered sheets of paper which covered the table. It is only fair, she observed smilingly, that I should replace your paperweight. She gave me her hand, which felt soft and cold like the skin of a serpent, and we departed. We passed for some time with the velocity of an arrow through a fluid and grayish expanse, in which half-formed silhouettes flitted swiftly by us to right and left. For an instant we saw only sky and sea. A few moments later, obelisks commenced to tower in the distance. Pylons and vast flights of steps guarded by sphinxes became clearly outlined against the horizon. We had reached our destination. The princess conducted me to a mountain of rose-colored granite, in the face of which appeared an opening so narrow and low that it would have been difficult to distinguish it from the fissures in the rock, had not its location been marked by 2 stelae wrought with sculptures. Hermonthis kindled a torch and led the way before me. We traversed corridors hewn through the living rock. Their walls, covered with hieroglyphics and paintings of allegorical processions, might well have occupied thousands of arms for thousands of years in their formation. These corridors, of interminable length, opened into square chambers, in the midst of which pits have been contrived, through which we descended by cramp irons and spiral stairways. These pits again conducted us into other chambers, opening into other corridors, likewise decorated with painted sparrowhawks, serpents coiled in circles, the symbols of the Tau and Pedum, prodigious works of art which no living eye can ever examine. Interminable legends of granite which only the dead have time to read through all eternity. At last we found ourselves in a hall so vast, so enormous, so immeasurable that the eye could not reach its limits. Files of monstrous columns stretched far out of sight on every side, between which twinkled livid stars of yellowish flame, points of light which revealed further depths incalculable in the darkness beyond. The Princess Hermonthis still held my hand and graciously saluted the mummies of her acquaintance. My eyes became accustomed to the dim twilight, and objects became discernible. I beheld the kings of the subterranean races seated upon thrones, grand old men, though dry, withered, wrinkled like parchment, and blackened with naphtha and bitumen, all wearing scents of gold and breastplates and gorgets, glittering with precious stones, their eyes immovably fixed like the eyes of sphinxes, and their long beards whitened by the snow of centuries. Behind them stood their peoples, in the stiff and constrained posture enjoined by Egyptian art, all eternally preserving the attitude prescribed by the hieratic code. Behind these nations, the cats, ibises, and crocodiles, contemporary with them, rendered monstrous of aspect by their swathing bands, mewed, flapped their wings, or extended their jaws in a saurian giggle. All the pharaohs were there, all the dark rulers of the pyramids and syrinxes, on yet higher thrones sat Cronos and Xisuthros, who was contemporary with the deluge, and Tubal-Cain, who reigned before it. The beard of King Xisuthros had grown 7 times around the granite table, upon which he leaned, lost in deep reverie and buried in dreams. Further back, through a dusty cloud, I beheld dimly the 72 Priadamite kings with their 72 peoples, forever passed away. After permitting me to gaze upon this bewildering spectacle a few moments, the Princess Hermonthis presented me to her father Pharaoh, who favored me with a most gracious nod. "I have found my foot again! I have found my foot!" cried the princess, clapping her little hands together with every sign of frantic joy. "It was this gentleman who restored it to me. The races of Kemi, the races of Nahasi, all the black, bronzed, and copper-colored nations repeated in chorus, 'The Princess Hermonthis has found her foot again!'" Even Xisuthros himself was visibly affected. He raised his heavy eyelids, stroked his mustache with his fingers, and turned upon me a glance weighty with centuries. "By Ohms, the dog of hell, and Tme, daughter of the Sun of Truth, this is a brave and worthy lad," exclaimed Pharaoh, pointing to me with his scepter, which was terminated with a lotus flower. "What recompense do you desire?" Filled with that daring inspired by dreams in which nothing seems impossible, I asked him for the hand of the Princess Hermonthis. The hand seemed to me a very proper antithetic recompense for the foot. Pharaoh opened wide his great eyes of glass in astonishment at my witty request. "What country do you come from, and what is your age?" "I'm a Frenchman, and I'm 27 years old, venerable Pharaoh." 27 years old, and he wishes to espouse the Princess Hermonthis, who is 30 centuries old, cried out at once all the thrones and all the circles of nations. Only Hermonthis herself did not seem to think my request unreasonable. "If you were even only 2,000 years old," replied the ancient king, "I would willingly give you the princess, but the disproportion is too great, and besides we must give our daughters husbands who will last well. You do not know how to preserve yourselves any longer. Even those who died only 15 centuries ago are already no more than a handful of dust. Behold, my flesh is solid as basalt. My bones are bars of steel. I will be present on the last day of the world with the same body and the same features which I had during my lifetime. My daughter Hermonthis will last longer than a statue of bronze. Then the last particles of your dust will have been scattered abroad by the winds, and even Isis herself, who was able to find the atoms of Osiris, would scarce be able to recompense your being. See how vigorous I yet remain, and how mighty is my grasp," he added, shaking my hand in the English fashion with a strength that buried my rings in the flesh of my fingers. He squeezed me so hard that I awoke and found my friend Alfred shaking me by the arm to make me get up. "Oh, you everlasting sleeper, must I have you carried out into the middle of the street and fireworks exploded in your ears? It is afternoon. Don't you recollect your promise to take me with you to see Monsieur Aguado's Spanish pictures?" "God! I forgot it all about it," I answered, dressing myself hurriedly. "We will go there at once. I have the permit lying here on my desk." I started to find it, but fancy my astonishment when I beheld, instead of the mummy's foot I had purchased the evening before, the little green paste idol left in its place by the Princess Hermonthis. And that story was The Mummy's Foot by Théophile Gautier, from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Sunday at the Zoo by Stuart Dybeck. We decided to stop drinking and spend Sunday at the zoo. It was going nicely until she worked herself up over the observation that it was a horrible thing to cage the animals. "That's not very profound," I said. "Everybody who goes to the zoo feels that sometime." "Oh, you cruel bastard," she screamed. "I'm not everybody." She bellied over the guardrail and flung herself against the bars of the wolf's cage. 3 wolves had been circling, and as soon as she touched the bars, they froze, fur bristling along their spines. She had her arms stuck in between the bars up to her shoulders and as much of her face as she could wedge in, yelling, "Eat me! Eat me!" to the wolves. Just that week, the newspapers had carried an account of how a small girl had an arm gnawed off. She'd reach in to pet them, and one wolf held it while the other ate. It was, in fact, what had led us, along with the crowd, relentlessly to the wolves' cage. But the wolves held their ground, snarling, stiff-legged. An attendant came running down the aisle between the fence and cages and grabbed her by the hair and throat, wrestling her back. She locked her arms around the bars, and he kept slapping her face with a thick, purplish slab of meat he must have been feeding to one of the animals. "I'll give you eat me," he grinned, kicking her down and grabbing his crotch. At that instant, all three wolves rushed against the bars so that they shook, and you could hear their teeth breaking on the metal. Their bloodied snouts jabbed through, snapping at air. "Stop abusing that woman," I shouted from the crowd. And that was Sunday at the Zoo by Stuart Dybeck from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And now from the World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. Bedtime Story by Jeffrey Whitmore. "Careful, honey, it's loaded," he said, re-entering the bedroom. Her back rested against the headboard. "This for your wife?" "No, too chancy. I'm hiring a professional." "How about me?" He smirked. "Cute. But who'd be dumb enough to hire a lady hitman?" She wet her lips, sighting along the barrel. "Your wife." And that was Bedtime Story by Jeffrey Whitmore from the World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.